Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Respect. That's all that people want when they come into our court. Just a little respect. And fairness. So observed my guest today, Judge Tanya Bransford of Minnesota's 4th Judicial District, in her opening remarks 11 years ago at the Minnesota Justice Forum on the court, data, and racial disparities. Judge Bransford, I'm proud to say, is a 1980 cum laude graduate of Gustavus and distinguished jurist. She earned her J.D. from Hamline University, now Mitchell Hamline School of Law, and has served on the Hennepin County District Court bench since her appointment in 1994. From 2006 to 2008, she was the county's presiding juvenile court judge and leader of the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative. Prior to her present position, she worked in private practice and as a district court referee for Hennepin County's Juvenile Division and workers' compensation judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings, the first Black woman in both positions. She's the recipient of numerous awards, including the Hennepin County Administrators Award, the Champions of Change Award, the Annie E. Casey Foundation Award, the Hennepin Lawyer Diversity and Inclusion Award, and the Distinguished Alumna Award from Hamline University School of Law. As the opening quote suggests, Judge Bransford is a leader in efforts to ensure equity and fairness in the criminal justice system. Toward that end, she has chaired the Hennepin County District Court's Equal Justice Committee and the National Consortium of Racial and Ethnic Fairness in the Courts Conference. With the historic confirmation of the first Black woman, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, to the U.S. Supreme Court just weeks away at the time of this recording, and nearly 1 year after the murder of Mr. George Floyd by Minneapolis police, now seemed an especially opportune time to speak with Judge Bransford about her own journey and career, and I'm so delighted she could join me. So, Your Honor, Tanya, if I may, welcome to the podcast. It's a privilege and a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much, Greg, for inviting me. And I'm just sorry that our paths didn't cross at Gustavus.
Yeah, gee, I know. It would have been fun. We missed each other by about 6 years. But here we are, and we can connect in person, I hope, at some point. So I really appreciate you taking the time out. You said you managed to finish your morning case a little earlier, but still, I know how busy you are, and I greatly appreciate you taking the time to join me. And our listeners. So why don't we start with the pandemic? Because I'm interested in how people are working through that, especially the courts. What has that been like for you as a judge during? Has it all been virtual? How has it worked?
Well, the pandemic really affected the courts because I'll never forget when the first lockdown happened in March of 2020, everyone was, you know, we just stopped doing court because we said, how can we have people come down to court when we're not there? But we were able to quickly pivot and start doing hearings using Zoom. And so what we did was we started doing remote hearings, and people had to set up offices in their homes. And we went and took pictures of the courtroom, set the courtroom as the backdrop for our, you know, Zoom background, and had everybody connect. Now, so for a while we were doing 100% remote, but I've been in the juvenile court assignment. Hennepin County is so big, we have over 60 district court judges plus a number of referees. And so we have specialty areas. And so I have chosen to come back to the specialty area of juvenile court, where we have 10 judges right now. So in juvenile court, we don't have jury trials except in very unusual circumstances. It has to be a real serious case. It has to be a certain type of case that it's called extended jurisdiction juvenile. Anyway, it's very rare. So therefore, we were able to proceed with most of our hearings and didn't have as big a backlog as the cases that needed jury trials.
That's
so
good.
That was good in a way, but it was also really strange because you want people, especially young people, to understand and respect the seriousness of court.
Yes.
And so judges have all kinds of stories about people connecting to the Zoom hearing. Sometimes it was helpful because if they had to work, they could just go into their car and connect on their phone and take a break from work. Sometimes they were actually at work and taking a break. You could see, I've seen people like selling shoes and, you know, just all kinds of things. I've seen parents though call their kids and say, oh, just a minute, you have court, and make them wake up in time to get to court. People have appeared in court from their beds. Ugh. And I heard a story, but this one did. Oh, and even from like going to the bathroom.
Oh, no.
And so we're like, please, please, you know, the camera's on. Do not do that now. Do not. And so I stopped them from, you know, and then they just wash their hands and play it off. But yeah, so I guess those were decorum problems.
Right.
But some things are helpful in that people didn't have to take off a whole day or half day of work for a hearing that might be an hour.
Yeah.
Or 15 minutes. So some of those things were helpful.
Well, the decorum problems I can relate to as a professor. We have those even when we're in person. And I now have on my syllabi, I borrowed it from a colleague, it's a whole section on etiquette, literally what that part of the syllabus is called. And you're echoing what Judge Krista Jass, who's a history major at Gustavus, has said too about decorum. I like the idea of having the courtroom as a background, right? I mean, even if it's just virtual, that I hope helped a bit to, you know, lend a sense of the importance of the situation or the moment. Wow, I can't. What about jury trials? I mean, I was trying to imagine what are those like if they're on via Zoom. I mean, is the jury paying attention or how does that work?
You know, that's interesting because there's some jurisdictions that have started doing jury trials remotely. And for instance, I was at a national conference and Washington State has started doing some jury trials remotely.
Wow.
We have not done that, although I think there's been a little bit of experiment with doing a civil jury trial remotely.
Okay.
My concern would be, just as you're concerned when you teach remote students remotely, is whether or not they're paying attention.
Right.
So, and whether or not they're looking up other things. Because one of the things that we always tell jurors is that you can decide this case solely upon the evidence that you hear in this courtroom. You cannot look anything else up. You can't do any of your independent research. But in the reality, when you have jurors present in the courtroom and they go home that night, they could still look things up.
Sure.
But most times we expect that jurors honor their oath, that they are deciding the case just based upon the facts as presented in the courtroom and the evidence as presented in the courtroom, and then they have to make the findings of fact. So I think it could be difficult, but there would be certain rules, I'm sure, such as all cameras must be on.
Right.
You know, you couldn't have any off cameras.
Right.
You couldn't look up anything. You would have to raise your hand if you had a question. You'd have to make sure that you could be heard, that the jurors could hear and see everything. I know that when I've done some court trials where I'm the trier of fact, I have changed the screen so that it's speaker view so that they're large. I've come into the courtroom to do it and we have really large, like 6-foot screens where we connect to Zoom. So then we actually see the witnesses larger than life.
Yes.
So that I can do good credibility determinations. So there's ways in which we've done hybrid hearings or we've done them, you know, there's ways that you can do that. But then I want to make sure that we also cut off the chat feature.
Oh, sure.
So that witnesses can't chat with each other while one's testifying. We've had some situations where maybe there was somebody that was in custody and he was charged with domestic violence against a mother, and we found out later that he was using the chat feature to like say things to the mother that he wasn't supposed to have any communication with. So we stopped the chat feature. So there's certain things that you can do.
Well, it's amazing fascinating how the technology is a plus in some ways, even apart from the pandemic, but also a negative. And I mean, as a juror, ideally I'd want to be in the courtroom so I could really see, just as a teacher, see the witnesses, the defendants' faces. And then, yeah, it's not just a decorum problem. It's a whole, you know, responsibility and ethics problem as well. We shall see. I did not know that about Washington State. That's interesting. I actually hope it doesn't. I can understand the convenience aspect, but in a way, I hope Minnesota doesn't go that route. Well,
I don't think we will, and we have not for criminal cases, especially because the right to confront. And another example is that even though you can see people's faces, say, as you can on the Zoom screen from maybe the waist up, there's still more of the body language that you can't exactly see.
Sure. Yeah, that's right. Wow.
An example of that is when I had attorneys saying, well, judge, there'll be another attorney handling this case from now on. And I'd been seeing this particular attorney for a number of months. And I said, why? And she said, because I'm going on maternity leave. Well, we couldn't tell. You know what I mean? You can't even tell the way, because it's just from the chest up.
Right.
And there's other kinds of examples like that where I had a couple of colleagues, and then I finally met them in person instead of just on Zoom. One was, they were both female. One was 5'11 and the other was 4'11. But Zoom is the great equalizer because they all look the same in their small little boxes, you know?
Yeah, so there's just that is so interesting. And you just reminded me, you know, I was on a, for our history department, we did a recent search. Well, actually, maybe we did a couple. We had to do them online because of the pandemic. But increasingly, they're being done that way, I think. And it's different. I mean, it's both good and bad. But again, what you just said about seeing the whole person, the body language, I don't know. I don't know whether the online, you know, works against implicit bias or enhances it. I just don't know. But it's different, that's for sure.
I think that would be a really interesting study for someone to do, whether in hiring or other things, whether interviewing online and doing things like that decreases the implicit bias. That would be really interesting, study to
I
find
agree.
Out.
I'm not going to do it. I'll leave that to someone else, but and maybe someone's even done it. But yeah, it's pros and cons. Let's talk about your background a bit. I mean, I know you went to Gustavus, you graduated in 1980, but tell us where you grew up.
Well, really, I grew up in St. Paul and Maplewood. I went to North St. Paul High School.
Oh, yeah.
I was recruited. I knew that Gustavus was a good school, I think, from my high school teachers. I had some high school teachers that were Gustavus graduates.
Okay.
But anyway, I was recruited. I think it was Stan Waldhauser came and picked up me.
Steve Waldhauser. Maybe his brother, Stan. Could have been his brother. Yeah, anyway.
Definitely a Waldhauser. No, yeah. I can't remember which one. Anyway, and so they came and picked me up along with my friend who became, I didn't know her at the time, but we came down and visited Gustavus. And I had a really wonderful visit when I was a senior. I was already, people were friendly. They were welcoming. And I was already accepted at Carleton and almost went to Carleton, but I had a really bad visit at Carleton where they were saying, even though I was really good at reading and writing and I was a good student, but they were like, you better, what did they say? They said at Carleton that they had to close the libraries in order to force anyone to go to any sporting events. And that it seemed like it was really competitive. And they said, you better take up speed reading and you better do this and that. And so I don't know. I just had a really strange visit where they made it seem like I wouldn't have made it. And I thought, what? Yeah. But at Gustavus, the students were very warm and welcoming and the professors seemed good too. So I said, well, let me just try Gustavus.
That's really so interesting. A theme of this podcast has been, maybe half joking, I guess, but if only we could get every student in the country to come to prospective student to the campus, we'd have them all. I don't know. It's just because I felt that way, even as a visiting, you know, when I was being interviewed, I thought, my God, I'd gone to one other school and didn't care for the atmosphere there. And then came to Gustavus for the job interview. I was like, oh my God, you know, this feels great. But I wonder, did it concern you at all that it was a mostly white campus? I mean, was that in your head at all at the time?
It was. I was aware of that. And now my parents both went to, well, my father specifically grew up in rural Maryland, and the high school he graduated from was Bel Air Colored High School. He grew up in the era before Brown versus Board of education. And so he went to a colored high school. And so, and my mother graduated from nursing school at Harlem Hospital School of Nursing, which at the time she graduated in 1954, Brown versus Board of Education. Yeah. And that was one of the few nursing schools that allowed African-American women, because it was hardly any men that were nurses then, to go to the school to become nurses. So they had that experience. Although my dad had graduated from McAllister, he had started out in a predominantly historically black school, Lincoln University. Oh, yeah. So it was basically our finances at the time wouldn't allow me to go to Fisk or at another historically black school. Okay. And I needed to go to school in Minnesota. So I got Minnesota scholarships, and Gustavus also gave scholarships. That being said, the African-American students were very welcoming when I first got there. There was a black student organization. We had a BSO room, like an area where we'd have parties. And so even though it was a small number, I felt welcomed and that people kind of embraced. And it was interesting because we have reconnected on Facebook, and some of the people that I went to Gustavus with that were in the Black Student Organization, BSO, what we called it at the time, we've reconnected and are, you know, together like on Facebook and commenting, and we've had some virtual meetings where we just checked in with everyone and see how everyone's doing.
That's great. And actually, I may be in touch with you again about that, because I'm very interested in that history. Some historians have written about the recruitment of black students to Gustavus in the 60s through Bruce Gray and Owen Samuelson, two white alums, then administrators driving around Mississippi. I mean, it's amazing.
I know, it seems amazing, doesn't it? But I think once they got some people there, and some people came in from Chicago and other places, but a lot came from, what was it, Quitman County, Mississippi.
Exactly. Yep, that's exactly right. Was Phil Bryant there in the English department? He was a fellow Chicagoan like me. Was he there? I don't know if he was part of your... I can't remember when Phil graduated.
He was not there when I was there.
What about William Green? Was he, Bill Green might have been.
Bill asked. Green, the professor?
Yes.
He was also ahead of me.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So I got to know him after I graduated, but not during.
Okay. Yeah. It's just an amazing number of really interesting, all alums, but black alums are historians and law, just in all walks of life, really interesting history there. But so you felt welcome. Did the place feel, I guess it was segregated though, right? Was there much interaction between black students and white students outside of class or teams?
Well, I was in the Gustavus Concert Choir for a little bit, and I had some good friends from choir, and I still have some good friends this many years later. And so they were maybe from my major, or we were C-ups. So although I did some socializing with the black students, and, you know, there was still like, we mostly sat together in the cafeteria or whatever, but there was still some socializing outside of that as well.
Okay.
There was some, but to be honest, there was a big, when I was at Gustavus, the legal drinking age had decreased to age 18.
Oh my gosh.
So I was not into the things like case day, where people would want to drink a whole case of beer. Yes. It was so gross. And so one of the things I was involved with is, it seems like it was, I got to get her name right, Judy Douglas.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
We had a kind of like semi-formal dance that we organized that was, it was good music and everything, but it was all about, we can have fun without alcohol.
Right. Judy Douglas was an alcohol education. Yeah.
Right. So we did some, I just remember that she helped us with that. So we were saying, hey, it's okay. You can still dance. You can have a good time, and you don't have to drink alcohol, or at least drink that much alcohol. It just seemed like it was a little overboard.
It was crazy.
I wasn't into that kind of part of the campus.
You're speaking, I was the same way. My father never drank. I think he had a sip at my wedding, my brother's wedding. He didn't need to drink. He was Greek American, so he was gregarious enough. But anyway, I didn't The idea of going to bars to me as an undergraduate meant just screaming, yelling, people drunk out of their minds. And it's not for me, or dorm room party. So I didn't have my first bar alcohol experience until I think I was in graduate school. And it turned out to be a quiet bar. I thought, oh, this is kind of nice, where, you know, people were conversing while they were drinking, not just drinking to get drunk. So right. I have to say things are better at Gustavus that way. It was still that case day, I think, is less. I don't even know if it still occurs. It's less of an event than it used to be, thank goodness. So that's all very, very interesting to me. Were you involved in leadership positions all in the BSO or in other organizations on campus?
I was. I became the president of BSO my junior year.
Wow.
And then my dad laughingly says that I had to become an honorary Swede when I was at Gustavus, because at the time we had something, I don't know if they still have it, Guild of St. Ansgar and Guild of St. Lucia. I was a member of both of those. We didn't have Phi Beta Kappa then. I don't know that I would have made it, but I was trying. You know, I had above a 3.5, that kind of thing. So it was honors weekend or something. And so my parents came down and we did stuff. And then he was just laughing and said, well, look, my daughter became an honorary Swede because she's in the Guild of St. Lucia and the Guild of St. Ansgar. So I did those kind of things when I was at Gustavus. I also, when I went to college, I was debating between law and journalism.
Okay.
So my work study job was for the paper, the Gustavus.
The weekly.
So I worked on the weekly.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. I don't know that I wrote articles as much, maybe a couple articles, but it was more just helping to put it together and things like that.
Yeah.
But one of my highlights, though, at Gustavus was being able to participate in the Washington Semester Program, which I assume they still had, through the Political Science Department. And my political science professor, Don Ostrom, was our advisor that went with us. And of course, there were students from all sorts of schools, similar schools that went. But we lived on American University campus. I had an internship with Congressman John Conyers out of Detroit.
Wow.
And I wrote my independent study on the history of the Congressional Black Caucus, because he was one of the founding members of that.
Yes.
And my very good friend Aaron Jordahl and I were both, we roomed together. And before that, that was a senior year. And junior year, we were both RAs in, not RAs, CFs, down the hall from each other. So we didn't room together. But anyway, it was a fun, exciting time. I went to my first Congressional Black Caucus event out there then, and
that is cool.
Heard Shirley Chisholm
speak.
Wow. So it was very cool. And we even got to go, because this was before, so this was 1979. So it was way before 9/11. So we were pretty close. I have a pretty close picture of President Carter, because he was entertaining somebody on the White House South Lawn. I think it was somebody from Ireland, like the Prime Minister or something from Ireland. So you didn't have to be as far away. So we could just come and do that. And then the Congress used to have all these big receptions, and people used to come from all kinds of parties. I mean, from both the Democrats and the Republican parties, they would come to these receptions, but all of the congressional staff people would come and the interns would come, and then we could get like good food to eat for free.
Excellent. Wow. I mean, yeah, I sometimes wonder if I had had that opportunity, how my life would have been different. I happen to love Washington, D.C. I sometimes tell my students, I wish I'd been a lawyer. I know, I mean, you know, God knows I know enough lawyers who do drudgery work. But in any case, I just find that whole semester is so cool. And the fact that you were working with Conyers and then one of my heroes and then working, on the Congressional Black Caucus, that is just amazing.
One of the things that I really remember is that, Conyers, now again, this was 1979, Conyers authored the bill to try to make Martin Luther King Day a federal holiday.
Yes, that's exactly, yes.
And I remember going to listen to arguments for that bill to be passed. And Coretta Scott King was with us, because she was there as a guest of as a guest of Congressman Conyers. And I do remember a Republican saying, a white male Republican saying that Martin Luther King wasn't a great enough man to have a holiday named after him, like Lincoln was or whatever. Wow. So it was interesting how Conyers kept pushing, and then it finally passed. I believe it was became a federal holiday in the 80s, but it was not at that time.
No, that is absolutely right. Reagan resisted. President Reagan finally signed it. And there's a lot of fairly recent historical work on that, which is both depressing and inspiring. You know, you got to meet Shirley Chisholm. She's really, I think I heard you, read or heard you say when I was preparing for the podcast, she's one of your sheroes. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah. How come? What is that about?
Well, it is because when she was the first Black woman to run for president from a major political party. Yeah. And when I was in, I don't know, junior high, I got to think about what year she might have run. But anyway, and you would go to the, what is it called? No, I'm blanking.
Oh, the caucus? Anyway,
when you go to the precinct caucus, I went with my father. I couldn't vote yet. Oh. And so my father showed me about going to precinct caucuses and the fact that he cast his vote for Shirley Chisholm. And so, you know, at the precinct caucus level. So those kind of things, I think, stimulated my interest in politics so that I wound up majoring in political science. And then when I was out in Washington, D.C., she was presenting at one of the Congressional Black Caucus events.
Oh, I'm envious. So envious. One of my heroes, too.
Yeah, so that it was just really exciting to see how she, as an immigrant and coming out of New York City, you know, and I had read her autobiography, Unbought and Unbossed. Yeah. So I was just really excited to meet her because she really just made a difference in people's lives and she broke through some glass ceilings.
Absolutely. And I think she might have first run in 68 and then 72. She's an amazing woman. We have my wife has a Shirley Chisholm mug, which you know, coffee mug lets me use on occasion. Anyway, and great. Yeah, I just like that. I like that she was already one of your heroes at that young age. The decision to become or to go to law school, did that come out of the Washington semester program, do you think, or?
Okay, so something else that Gus Davis had available, it was the J term, January term.
Yes, we still
so
do.
One January term, and it's so fun because you get to explore different things. This was an example I was remembering. Freshman year, January term, I was a part of a play that the BSO put on, and it was it was a predominantly African-American play. I'll think about the name of it in a second. But where we use songs like Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life, Living in the City, and that kind of thing. So it was really interesting. I was able to find out that I really, really love theater, but I'm not a good actor. At least, you know, they tried to get me to act like I was a heroin addict. I'd never seen any heroin, so that wasn't going to work. But one of the J terms that I did that was particularly helpful was that I got to shadow a law firm, and that was the Legal Rights Center.
Oh,
so
wow.
There was, I did for my one January term, I got credit by just following the attorneys around from the Legal Rights Center, which is a center in Minneapolis, which provides free defense work for indigent people, primarily from the African American and Native American communities at that time. It's expanded beyond now. And so the person that I shadowed was Pam Smith. And so I was able to see all these other lawyers and see how they worked with the community and see how they went into court and advocated and defended people. And I said, ooh, this is really what I want to do. And so that just kind of helped to seal the deal to say that, yes, I definitely wanted to go to law school. So I knew I wanted to go to law school and I had taken my LSAT. But then when I graduated, I said, well, let me just look for jobs so I can get a little of life experience before I actually go to law school because I was 20. Now, interestingly enough, some of my friends that, because I graduated from college at age 20 and and high school at age 16. Oh, so I said, oh, let me just get a little bit of experience. And so I applied for this job as a court clerk, because I thought that would get, administrative clerk. I thought that would give me great experience to see what it's like from the inside. And it was with Judge Miles Lord.
Oh, yeah.
And Judge Miles Lord was a federal judge for many years in Minnesota.
Right.
So
well,
I took the bus and went to interview with him. And it was August after I graduated. And he said, well, young lady, it says right here that you want to be a lawyer. And I said, I do, sir. Yes, I've already taken the LSAT and did that. But I said, I get a little experience first. And he said, well, you should just go to law school right now. And so he called his friend that was the dean of Hamline Law School. And he ordered me. He said, I got this young lady here. I think she'll be great for law school. And I was like, excuse me? And so he said, they're looking for you. You got to go over there and interview. And I said, I'm sorry, but I took a bus. It'll take me a while to get back over to St. Paul. So he had his law clerk drive me back over there. And then 3 weeks later, I was at Hamline Law School. So I always said that, quote unquote, the Lord told me to go. So I felt like, you know, since it was Judge Lord, so I kind of felt like maybe that's why I wound up there. It was kind of strange that it happened. So I knew I wanted to go to law school, but actually going straight on right there really happened because I didn't get the job. Instead, he told me to go to law school.
That is a great story. Wow. I didn't dig that up on you. Wow, that's very interesting. Very cool. The we historians, this is another theme of the podcast, contingency, how things might have been different, right? Depending how things were different, depending on what happens. That's amazing. Yeah, the Lord told me to go. Wow. So off you went. And then you got into private practice. What were you doing then? What kind of law were you doing in private practice? And I should say, by the way, the legal rights organization, that what you described, that's my fantasy. I mean, if I could go to law school and work for an organization like that, I would be I think I'd be happy. In any case, what kind of law were you doing in private practice?
So I learned from undergrad that just graduating cum laude and being really great wasn't going to be enough to guarantee you a job when you graduated. So, and my parents were very enthusiastic about me going to law school, but were clear about the fact they weren't going to continue to support me upon my graduation from law school. So therefore, I knew I had to make sure that I could be employable. So I was fortunate to be able to get a summer clerkship position with the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office. So that was great. But I also was able to get a clerkship with a private law firm. And so then I had offers from both when I graduated. I chose the private law firm. And what I was doing with them, it's because I did workers' compensation, where we did both defense work and we represented people who were injured on the job. We did personal injury work. It was really a true general practice firm. We did some defense work. We did some divorce work. So I got to try all these different things, even a bankruptcy. So I knew I never wanted to do that again. Didn't really want to, you know, so it was truly a general practice law firm. And there were three other lawyers when I first got there, and we wound up with five. Again, I was the first African-American and the first woman at the law firm. But it was, in those days, it was frequently that you were the first or the only if you were a Black woman.
Yeah. Excuse me, sure, I can imagine. Did you, you know, I'm curious then, kind of fast forwarding a bit, how does one become a judge? I mean, did you aspire at some point to be on the bench or how did that happen in 1994? That's the first time you became a judge in 94?
Well, what I discovered is that when you're an attorney and you advise people or clients or entities, they don't always take your advice. Yeah. And that got a little frustrating sometimes. And so I also found that with my personality, I was better to be the neutral, the arbitrator, the mediator, to try to bring people together and come up with a common good solution. And at the time, there was not as much alternative dispute resolution, ADR, as there is now in the courts. And so I was really able to see, gosh, maybe I would want to be a judge. And what I didn't say is the lawyer that I was following at the J term at Legal Rights Center, her name was Pam Smith. And then she became Pam Alexander. She became a mentor of mine. And then when I was in the public defender's office, she was a prosecuting attorney in the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. In 1982, she became appointed as the first Black woman judge in the state of Minnesota.
Wow.
And then I was still in law school and I was like, well, if she could do it, maybe I can do it. You know, like you can actually, like someone I actually know and I witnessed what a great litigator she was. This is a possibility. And so it was Governor Rudy Perpich appointed both Pam Alexander and Mike Davis, which was highly unusual that he appointed two. And in that sense, we went from one Black judge in Hennepin County to three. So it was a big dramatic step forward.
That was
forward.
A big deal. Yeah.
It was a big deal. But anyway, so that gave me the impetus that I thought I could do it. I was fortunate enough that there was different areas of judgeship you could do. So I did some workers' compensation work and I had some trials. And there was an opening in the Office of Administrative Hearings as a workers' compensation judge. So I got that just about 5 years after I graduated from law school. Okay. So I became a workers' compensation judge. And in that capacity, you have to decide how badly the person was injured, what kind of benefits they're entitled to, and whether or not the injury was work-related or not, and whether or not they were, you know, permanently and totally disabled. I was really shocked to find out that some people really were in our state, which is so good for education. It was primarily people that worked like hard labor, like using their back, that they were really illiterate. That at the time they could just bring the documents home to their wife and their wife would like sign them and fill them out or whatever. And then they'd bring them back. And so then you'd have to find out if they were permanently and totally disabled or if they could be rehabilitated and do into another line of work. So that's the type of law of cases that we would handle in workers' compensation. And I did that in the Office of Administrative Hearings. And we did our own detailed findings of fact, conclusions of law and order. So thank you very much, Gustavus professors, because my ability to read, write, and articulate and come up with good findings and orders definitely helped, from what I learned at Gustavus and at Hamline Law School. So I did that for a number of years. And then I found out about a position as a juvenile court referee, and I applied for that.
And are these positions appointed or you apply to be?
You apply and you're appointed.
Okay.
So a referee is really like a judge because we wear a robe, we decide cases, but we're appointed technically by the chief judge of the district. And so the referees work in certain specialty areas. For instance, now we have referees that work in housing court, that work in family court, and they stay and they become specialized in that particular area of the law.
Okay. Boy, they
make less than judges, but the advantage is you don't run for reelection.
You're just appointed. That's why you're appointed, yeah. Well, you've made, this is all incredibly interesting to me, and you've certainly made my week, my month, and what you just said about your Gustavus education and preparing you. I mean, so many people think liberal arts, what can you do? What can you do with the liberal arts? What can't you do with, what can you do without them? I mean, learning to read, think, write, analyze data, research, all part of your work. In 94, you're appointed. Who was governor then? Who appointed you?
That was Governor Arne Carlson.
Carlson, okay.
And yes, I was appointed by him. And it wasn't just like, hi, Governor Carlson. But you had to apply. You had to get your written application in. And then there was a panel of 13 people, not quite like the Senate Judiciary Committee that Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson had to go through or any federal judge has to go to. But there was, and thank goodness it wasn't public, but there was 13 people sitting around the conference table and you, and they were grilling you and asking asking all kinds of questions. And then if you make that list, then you go, then you're on the short list or the finalist list that goes to the governor. And then the governor asks you questions along with a couple of other staff and other people that he has. So, you just really, I had to make sure that it's a combination of being prepared, but also being of good luck. And so, yes. So I made sure that I was on the Bar Association. I was involved in Minnesota Women Lawyers. I was involved in the Minnesota Association of Black Lawyers. In those days, I think it was still Minnesota Minority Lawyers Association. But in any event, and then I was also involved in the State Bar Association, all those kind of connections and community organizations. I was in something called Action for Children. And I have to admit, it didn't hurt that I happened to have graduated from law school also with Governor Carlson's wife, Susan Carlson. And so when we had a reunion from law school, I told my husband, you don't have a choice. We have to go to this one. It's going to be the reunion is at the governor's mansion. So we will be there, so that he can at least see who I am.
Very good move and good luck. Yeah. So yeah, you're obviously incredibly prepared. Well prepared, and then you're being honest, a bit of luck there too. That's funny. Governor Carlson, my wife Kate and I live in downtown Minneapolis at Grant Park, the Grant Park community, and I think he may still be in our building. I know my wife ran into him at a polling place once and got to talk politics with him. That's all extremely interesting. And then you have to stand for election, right? Is it every 6 years or how? What is your
term? Every 6 years, yeah. Yes.
So yep. You've been, I don't know how many, like, not going to do my math quick. I can't do it, but you've been
quite a bit. I've only had one contested election. Sure. And so that was a little strange because it turns out that the person who ran against me, because I said, what? He had a relatively, in our world, smaller case. He was a landlord and he represented himself. He was a lawyer. And I ruled against him because he did not give the tenants their damage deposit back when you're supposed to after they leave. And I just followed the law and it said that if you don't do that, that you can get treble damages because we don't want landlords to do that. Right. And so the total amount was like $1,000 or $2,000, less than $2,000. But he was mad at, apparently, because I don't know what else it was. That's the only case he ever had before me. So he ran against me, but he didn't show up for anything. He just submitted it in writing. So I went around and campaigned. And it was the year I had my contested election was the same year that Senator Wellstone was killed in plane accident because we were going to be at a church along with some other people just explaining about our. Well, he was going to explain about his campaign and I was going to explain, yes, I'm a judge and judges run for re-election and we hope that you will, look and, that kind of thing. But it was a community-based,
Well, I know, and current term, when are you up for re-election? 27, I think, is that right?
I believe I'm up for re-election in 2026.
Oh, 26, yeah, 26 it would be, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, your term, that's right, then your term would end in 27, yeah. Well, that's a whole other podcast, electing judges and the pros and cons of that. But let's talk a little bit about your work as a judge. I mean, what is it like? Do you have a typical day? I mean, I don't know. What is your workload like and how do you approach it?
I just want to tell any listeners that if you want to be a judge because you think that it's a cushy job and you don't have to work hard, do not take this job because we do have a lot of work. We have a large caseload. Now, the judges in Hennepin County and Ramsey County, because we're so big, we can be specialized in certain areas, but judges in outstate, like I did note that you had talked to Judge Krista Jass, they really do everything. And so so every day can be a little bit different. But so as a judge, I have worked handling complex civil cases, trials versus between on contract disputes between multinational corporations that result in large verdicts of multi-million dollars, to handling a traffic dispute where someone wants a trial because the police officer said they went through the red light and they said they didn't. So it's a wide spectrum. Variety. Yeah. I've had, you know, murder cases, to resolving a child support dispute, maybe things like that. I haven't done personally as much family law. And I just want to stress that for a judge in outstate, they could have all of that in 1 week. Wow. And in like as in Hennepin, we can specialize in certain areas. So I've been specializing in juvenile court. So now my weeks are where I handle a large number of child protection cases where people, which are frequently because a parent or caregiver is either chemically dependent, has mental illness issues, or both. Those are the largest ones. And then those result in abuse or neglect of the children. And then sometimes they have to be placed in out-of-home placement in such as foster care. And we always look for relatives or families. And then we try to support the parent by providing resources and a case plan so that they can correct whatever the conditions were that led to the out-of-home placement so that we can reunify the family. So that's maybe 60 to 70% of the work that I do. The other percentage is delinquency cases. And unfortunately, we're getting a large number of youth that have been charged with very serious crimes where the state will file a motion to have them certified to adult court. And then we have to decide whether they should be certified to adult court or whether they can be in a blended situation so that they have adult prison time hanging over their head, but they get juvenile consequences and they stay on probation until they're age 21, or if they get straight juvenile. And young people, when they come in with small, like low-level offenses, we try our best to keep them in the community and to do community-based alternatives and to work on restorative justice kind of things.
All so that is it's so interesting. Important. Yeah, I imagine it's interesting. I think it's incredibly important. I mean, the historians, we talk about the carceral state. There's a whole subfield of history now, not just historians, but analyzing, you know, the number of people we have in this country, African-American, Black people, brown people, just, you know, in prison. It's insane in my view. But in any case, you're in the center of it. As you're speaking, I'm thinking, you know, I agonize so much sometimes over a grade, a single grade. You're deciding really in sometimes, you know, you're deciding, well, you are not just the fate. I mean, maybe not in a traffic red light case, running red light. You know, some heavy decisions you're making. How do you approach those? I mean, how do you approach these decisions? You obviously read, you prepare, but in one case, I remember you sentenced maybe more than once, certainly once, right? A defendant to life in prison. I just wonder what goes through your mind as you're thinking about these sentencing, or is it just, oh, here's the guideline, this is what I have to do?
No, it takes a lot out of you. It really does. And to be honest, that's why in some respects I have handled those cases before, but I would rather be, when I was doing adult felonies, I would rather handle what they call the property drug felonies, because those were more frequently, like if someone possessed drugs or if they were committing property offenses, but not person offenses, primarily because those cases were less likely to go to prison and we had more opportunities to try to get them rehabilitated, to try to see if they wanted to get sober, to provide opportunities to address their substance use issues. That's a much better outcome for me that it felt like than actually sentencing people to prison.
Sure.
So yeah, when you have to sentence someone to prison, I remember distinctly a first degree murder case that I had where everybody involved was 19. Mm. In other words, the person who was killed was a 19-year-old black man, and the two defendants were 19-year-old young black men. And I just felt like their whole lives were the person who had been killed obviously would never come back. But that whole family was grieving the loss of that person.
Right.
Yet, so you have to feel for the victims, but yet also feel for the defendants,
right,
especially when they're so young, to imagine at age 19 not having to give someone a life sentence, which at the time in Minnesota meant that you're not eligible for parole for at least 30 years.
Wow.
And so those of us who are, you know, I'm definitely over, you know, 60 at this point, to look back and to imagine how I was at age 19.
Yes.
And how, you know, spending 30 years of your life in custody. And so, yes, it's very hard. Now, there are a few people that I've seen that seemed like they had no remorse, or that if there's people that are, I would say, repeat offenders that continually hurt people, then you still take it very seriously and you follow the guidelines, you prepare, but it's less hard to
sure.
do that for someone yes. who's older and who's repeatedly offended against
right.
people. But yes, it's difficult. And I say, we read everything. We take the fact, as Judge Jackson said, you take the factors into consideration. You listen to the victims. You pay attention to the probation report and the information that you have. You find out more information usually about the defendant and their motivation or their background and whether or not they can be rehabilitated or what kind of things. So you find out all that kind of stuff, and then you just do the sentence.
Yeah. I mean, it's work, as you stress. I mean, one has to have a really strong ethic, as you obviously do. But also, yeah, I mean, it's weighty. It's morally weighty. I think you described it so well. I mean, I'm thinking that this is not, I don't mean to minimize what you're doing at all or elevate what I'm doing, but it's easy for me to give a student a D or an F when the student clearly has just not done the work and doesn't care and, you know, or has clearly plagiarized. It's hard as hell when it's sort of between, you know, a B and a B plus or a B plus. And I can sometimes just go agonize over that. Gotten better over the years, but yeah, in some cases it's clear cut. Others you realize, wow, this is a young person who's going to spend at least the next 30 years in prison. Yeah. So I can understand.
It's less than that. It does take, and having to decide another big, heavy case kind of thing that we have to decide is, and we have to weigh it very strongly, is whether we want to terminate someone's parental rights forever.
That
is enough, you know, and I just have to be honest. I have to pray about those kind of things too. Just, you know, just asking that I get that I make the right decision. But also just making sure that you're evaluating the facts, applying it to the law, and just really looking out for what's in the best interest of the children.
Yes. Yeah, that's another. I mean, that's a hard part of what you're doing now. What is it that attracted, aside from that, you don't have to make as weighty a decision, maybe. But what else attracted you to your current work with? And I know it's picking up where you were before, but your work with young people.
You know what attracts me is the idea, and sometimes we see it, that we can really make a difference in these individual people's lives. So as judges, we're not supposed to talk about pending cases, but I have a case that's over now that that really a young man had done something very, very bad. And but he went through... He pled guilty, but it was under a circumstance where if he had successfully completed probation, it could be kind of removed off his record. And he did so well and made such a turnaround. He was working, he was getting A's in school, he was regularly attending school, he was not associating with the bad crowd anymore. He made such a big difference that a police officer at the school appeared on the Zoom hearing and just said, "I just want to tell you what a great guy this is, and what amazing turnaround he's made in the last 2 years."
That's got to be so gratifying for you.
Obviously. And every now and then, I mean, that was unusual because I had to keep following it every 3 months to make sure how he was doing. Sometimes we don't know. And so every now and then people will just stop me on the street, like at Crave, at the restaurant. I remember being at the restaurant and the waiter took me aside when he was giving me my coat for me. And he said, "Judge Bransford, you made a difference. You gave me an opportunity on probation. I just want you to know that I'm working, I'm going wow. to school, I'm married, I'm doing really well now. And so thank you." And he just was whispering it so that other people didn't have to hear it. But
what an amazing moment.
you get things like that, and that stays entrenched in your brain. So the ability to help individuals and to help families, and I've seen some mothers get over domestic violence, get over their really make mental changes and understand that they are too valuable, that they can't suffer domestic violence nor their children anymore. And where almost everyone in the courtroom was crying because the mom had done such a good job and she was back with the children and everyone was happy that that reunification had happened. So those are what gives you the energy to keep going.
Yes.
So that's individual cases. And on the other hand, if we can make, sometimes if you work within the system, and I think it was Shirley Chisholm who said that, that if you have to, it's something about you have to know the system. And if you work within the system, you can pull up the chair. And, you know, if they don't give you a chair at the table, you know, you bring up your own chair and create it. But so being able to make systemic change that really improves the system and the fairness for all people that come before it is also something that gives me great motivation. And I'm very proud of the things that I was able to do within the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative and ways in which we were able to decrease the number of young people that were being locked up unnecessarily. They weren't locked up because they had committed a serious or violent offense, but we changed just the way we were doing things. And examples, people would say, what? Like, why should young people be locked up for like skipping school? Really? Skipping school, that's illegal. And so we stopped that. And we helped to start a Curfew Truancy Center, which has now morphed into the Juvenile Connection Center. You know, and so that's run so that police officers, if they stop, if they see young people out at 2 o'clock in the morning, they shouldn't be out at 2 o'clock in the morning. Before, in the olden days, you know, before, or I'd say before 2005 in Hennepin County, they would just bring them down to the detention center and make the detention center staff try to find their families or whatever. And we're like, why are you locking up these kids that haven't really committed any crimes with kids who have been alleged to have committed very serious offenses? That makes no sense. We're not supposed to do that. So we stopped doing that. And, so instead had them go to an outside agency where the agency could then find the parent and could find out if they're doing well in school or if they're doing well or not, and find out their school records and find out what kind of services they need at, rather than the detention center doing it. So there's different ways in which that's been that, and there's other smaller things that have happened since then and have continued on that have made definite positive changes within the system. And so it's just really great when you see that kind of thing happen.
I'm with you on this and Shirley Chisholm, and it's a change in my life. And I don't think it's just age, but the importance of knowing the system and being able to work within it and to affect change from within, even as there are people who we need pressuring from without. And you're anticipating my next question, which has to do with, I was going to ask you your sense of, I mean, just thinking, we can just put it, let me put it this way. You've got, you know, almost a year ago, the murder by police in Minneapolis of Mr. George Floyd. You've got other police killings of Black men and women. And then now this moment with Judge Jackson, who will be the first Black woman on the Supreme Court. What are your feelings as you, as a Black woman and a judge, as you think about these quite different moments?
Well, it's just with the George Floyd situation and all the other young African American people who, and people in general who have been killed by police, it's just tragic. And it's heartbreaking. And as a mother of a young African-American man, it's a shame when you are more worried that something may happen as a result of police interaction than you are anything else. And I was especially worried when he had long dreads that were beautiful, but I was worried that people would look at him and assume that he was a gangbanger instead of assuming that he was a college student majoring in engineering or a high school student who liked to do theater, you know, mm-hmm. and engineering, pre-engineering, as opposed to assuming that they're in a negative thing like that. So it's a fear I think that every parent has, every Black parent has, that they don't want their child to wind up as an accident. On the other hand, I have very good friends that are police officers, and I know that no police officer should go about their day thinking, oh, let's see who I can kill today, you know? So, but it's just so tragic when you see these things repeatedly happen, especially in our jurisdiction.
Right.
Then to see Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson being grilled day and night, because I thought it was over. And then I turned on the TV and I said, are they still questioning her? Is this a repeat from during the day? And I realized it was still live, and it was 10 o'clock at night in the East Coast, or at 9 o'clock.
It was so hard to watch. I couldn't watch all of it. It was so hard for me.
I was like, how many different ways can they ask her these horrible questions?
Right.
And so it was clear that she showed grace under fire.
Incredible grace.
That she showed outstanding judicial temperament. That she showed extreme patience in trying to explain the process. And they acted as if she only ever sentenced people on that one narrow area that they were talking about child pornography.
Right.
They didn't ask her anything, as far as I saw, about when she was an appellate judge, which would have been more similar to what she's doing, not what she will be doing on the Supreme Court, and about all her decisions in those regards. And I thought it was also striking that I read that the American Bar Association, of course, gave her the highest standards, said that they had interviewed over 250 people. And, you know, so it's just really frustrating when you see that the commonality of the fact that when you have a BIPOC person, an African-American, indigenous person, another person of color, that there's these assumptions that they must not be qualified, or that they must be criminals or something like that. And it's just horrible when that happens.
It's I mean, I'm a white male, and it's infuriating to me. I can only imagine what it's like for you and others to watch it and hear it. And for her, I it was nauseating. It was disgraceful, I thought. And I was so happy when Senator Cory Booker said what he said at the end to Judge Jackson. I mean, it's frankly just racism and misogyny. I mean, you know,
not that
hidden either, unfortunately.
No, it was just blatant.
Yeah.
Because what other Supreme Court nominee did they ever ask about critical race theory?
No, ridiculous.
And about kindergarten books.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
I'm like, really? Kindergarten books?
Right.
I mean, it was.
No, it was quite a show. And if I'm allowed to continue to teach about other historians, to teach about racism and the history of racism in this country, I'll probably use some of that as evidence. It's really, what we're talking about here in general is, you know, the reality that there has been progress, and certainly your efforts and others in the criminal justice system, there's been real progress. And yet at the same time, further progress is needed. And just as a teacher, I sometimes find it hard to find, you know, I don't know that there is a balance, but to make sure the students don't sort of say, well, nothing has changed, it never will change, versus everything's fine. You know, it's somewhere in between that. And we have to keep working at it as you've done for so many years. And progress does come, however slowly and fitfully. I know we're out of time here. You've been so gracious with your time, and I've even already kept you a little longer than I said I would. I want to conclude just by asking you about your dad, because you know he's such an interesting character. I mean, what to tell us a little bit about him, and when I say character, I mean person. And his influence on you?
Well, my dad was quite the intellectual, and he loved to read, and he would, I remember that he would volunteer and lead Black literature classes or groups at Women's Shakopee Prison. Wow. When I was still in high school or junior high school. He was a biochemistry major from McAllister College in 1957. And he did a lot of work like judging science fairs and things like that until his alcoholism really caught up with him. And so it was after two near fatal car accidents, mm-hmm. both times, incidentally, he was on his way to pick up my sister and I. Okay. But after two near fatal car accidents and numerous times in rehabilitation, he finally got sober in 1974. And at that point, he really totally changed his life and devoted his life towards helping other people get sober. And he was one, we now have things like drug courts and treatment courts, but he was really one of the forerunners in that he was with an organization called the Minnesota Institute on Black Chemical Abuse, which later became the Institute on Black Chemical Abuse, later became African American Family Services, where he would actually go in and vote and find a treatment program. Minnesota is the land of 10,000 treatment programs. He'd find a treatment program for the person, go into court with them as an intervention specialist, helping the defense attorney out, and say to the judge, you know, this person would really do well in this kind of treatment program, and so we could do this, and follow through. He had a great reputation among the judges because if the person didn't follow through, he would be honest, and he'd say, I'm sorry, they didn't stay on the wagon. We tried to get them. He would literally drive them to treatment programs himself and pick them up from the jail. And then as he got older, we're like, Dad, you got to stop doing that. That's not safe anymore. You know, like you're 78 now. You're still doing this. Could you please stop driving people from the jail? And then for a minute, he worked for not a minute, like 10 years or so, he worked in the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office as a dispositional advisor, then later kind of doing the same thing, but helping to provide alternatives to prison or jail for people to address their substance use issues. So he was really a motivating factor, as well as my mother, as far as community service. My mother was a Head Start nurse back in the 60s when Head Start first began. In the Twin Cities. And she did a variety of things. She was, doing things for clean indoor air and going against smoking in the early 70s when she was a nurse at 3M. So both of them, and she wound up being a community health nurse. And so both of them really instilled in my sister and I the need for community service and the need to just give back to the community. And they helped instill in me the love of public service. And my dad definitely helped instill in me the love of reading, writing, articulating. And they, encouraged me to go into law school and to pursue my dream to become a judge and working in the
world. That's all wonderful. I mean, they sound like amazing parents. I would have loved to have met them both. There's a wonderful picture. I don't know if it was in the obituary for your dad, but of you and your dad together somewhere, I saw you smiling. Kind of.
Yeah, that was an article that one of the Star Tribune writers did on my dad and myself for Father's Day, and my sister for Father's Day 1 year, and they came and they took that picture.
Beautiful picture. Beautiful picture.
So yeah, they said he's known throughout the courthouse. One story, so of course I couldn't have him appear in front of me because of the appearance of impropriety, but there was one case that I had and this is years ago, so I can't remember who, but I just remember that it was a Native American woman. I believe she was pregnant and she had, committed some kind of offense, and they said, we really need her to get into treatment. And so I looked at the lawyers and I said, okay, the only person I know that would know what treatment program for this Native American woman who is pregnant would be my dad. Do you guys mind if I call my dad? And they said, no, we think that'd be great. So we called him and he knew right away whatever treatment program it was. And so I'm like, okay, so can you guys work on that so we can see?
Wow. I don't know if anyone else is going to be able to fill his shoes, but those are big shoes to fill and incredibly important. I just think to see how, he was in the criminal justice system doing his thing, even as you're a judge, and it's I like the parallel lives there. parallel careers. So I said that was going to be kind of my last question, but actually, no, here's my last question. Do you want to say anything else about Gustavus, your pitch for Gustavus? I mean, I know you said earlier it prepared you, right, to read, write, think, et cetera. But anything else you'd say about the place to prospective students who might be listening?
One of the things I loved about Gustavus is that I felt like I really got to know the professors really well, especially in my major. But I remember, and when I said I got to know them really well, they really cared about you as a person. And then that relationship continued even with some of them, even after you leave Gustavus. So Professor Don Ostrom and I continued to exchange Christmas cards and continued to keep in touch. And I mean, for 30, 40 years after I graduated. Yeah. So that's quite something. I know when I would talk to my friends, maybe, and they were at the university or any large school, they would talk about, you know, at the time, standing in lines or feeling like you're a big number.
Right.
And I never felt like I was a number at Gustavus, whether it was the Dean of Students, Bruce Gray, whether it was, you know, the presidents or the professors. I just always felt like they recognized me as a person and that they supported me as a person and that they would look out for you in whatever you were striving to do. So again, I feel like although St. Peter itself was a really small town, it still is, I think, but I did feel like the opportunities that I took advantage of, specifically with the Washington Semester Program and with the J Term Program, shadowing the lawyer Pam Smith at the Legal Rights Center, I think it helped shape my life and influenced me in what I was going to do in the future. Oh, I remember taking business law too from Professor Kyle Montag.
Oh, Kyle Montag. Boomer Montag. Yeah.
Montag. Yes. Yeah. That kind of prepared me for real law school. I was like, oh my goodness, they're really calling me Miss Bransford. How are you going to rule on what's your response on this case?
Yeah. He was amazing.
Method.
Yeah, exactly. I remember I was a new faculty member at Gustavus and I'm teaching and I noticed Kyle Montag in the back of my classroom. I think, oh my God, what is he? I'm a wreck. I'm so nervous because I knew his reputation. Mm-hmm. all was fine. That's all well said. I think that's true. I mean, speaking as a professor, it's the thing I love most about teaching at a liberal arts college and teaching at Gustavus. I love getting together with alums. I love speaking to alums like you for this podcast. And maybe we'll get together in person at some point too. I hope we can. This has been a pleasure, interesting and a real pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time. You really embody the five core values of Gustavus, and excellence, community service, justice, and faith. It's just been delightful to speak with you. So thank you so much. Off to lunch. I hope you have time for that.
Thank you so much, Greg. I really appreciate the invitation to be a part of your podcast.
Thank you. And we'll hopefully see each other in person before long. Take good care.
Take good care.
Bye-bye.
Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.